From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
'Tis a gift to be simple, 'tis a gift to be free, 'tis a gift to come down where we ought to be. And when we find ourselves in the place just right, 'twill be in the valley of love and delight.
The Shakers came to America from England in 1774. They were pacifists, believed in equality between men and women, and between races, utopians who longed to create a godly community on Earth and who made beautiful furniture. At their height in the mid-1800s, they had 18 or so communities from Maine to Ohio, Kentucky, and beyond. Today, there is one remaining active Shaker community, and there are three Shakers. One of them is with us. This hour on Point, the Shakers, and how one of the three remaining sees the world. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What comes to mind when you think Shakers? Do you know their story, their way, their work? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. In a moment, we will talk with Brother Arnold Had, one of three surviving Shakers in the world. Joining me first from Portland, Maine, is Michael Komenecki. He's chief curator at the Farnsworth Art Museum in Rockland, Maine. The Farnsworth has a big Shaker exhibit on through January. Michael Komenecki is editor of a beautiful companion book, The Shakers from Mount Lebanon to the World. You can see images from the exhibit at our website, onpointradio.org. Michael Komenecki, thank you very much for being with us today.
Oh, you're welcome, Tom. Thanks very much for having us.
And with us from Albany, New York, is Jerry Grant, Director of Collections and Research at the Shaker Museum in Mount Lebanon, New York, site of the first Shaker community in America. Jerry Grant, thank you for joining us.
Good to talk to you, Tom.
We'll hear from Brother Arnold directly in a moment, but Jerry, set the stage for us, if you would. Who were the Shakers? What did they believe, practice?
Well, the Shakers were came out of that time in England when there was a lot of religious activity to sort of give the church back to the people, and they were one of the groups that were involved in trying to personalize religion and to own it for themselves. They were probably, and Brother Arnold can comment on this, probably came out of the same group that the Methodists came out of, and their attempts to form a church in England were difficult because of persecutions and because they didn't sort of sell out to the Church of England and agree to do what they wanted, behave the way that they wanted to. Their leader, Mother Ann Lee, suggested from a revelation she had that they come to America. And in 1774, a very small group of them took a ship and landed in New York City, actually on August 6th. So yesterday was landing day for the Shakers when they first set foot in America. They were a Protestant monastic community. They were a celibate order. They believed that marriage was unnecessary since they were living in trying to live the way that Christ lived as a celibate person. They formed themselves into communities and lived together as communal families, sharing all things in common as the apostles were commanded to do. That's, I think, the basic beliefs. They started their first community just north of Albany. It was their first settlement, and they came at a time when the American Revolutionary War was on, so they had some difficulty in finding a way to proselytize and get other people to join. They were sort of, I don't think they were ducking bullets, but it was the time in American history when you couldn't travel so easily around. But
and they were pacifists. They couldn't participate. It became an issue for them in the Civil War as well. I think Abraham Lincoln actually gave the Shakers an exemption. I'm reading here, Jerry, that at their height, they had communities, 18 communities, Maine, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Connecticut, New York, Kentucky, Ohio, Indiana, Georgia, Florida, as far as that, Jerry.
They spread out through the East Coast and into following the revivals that were happening in Kentucky and Ohio in around 1800 and beyond. They made lots of converts in that area and were able to form a half a dozen communities in that area as well. They were spread out. Yeah.
At their very height, even with 18 or 20 communities, I'm looking at only 5,000 full members. This was around 1840, 5 or 6,000. It's not a large number.
It was never a huge number. And part of it is that, you know, the demands of Shaker life are fairly strict. You give up everything of yourself and be a member of a community. I think that that's attractive to a limited number of people. I think the rewards were great for those who could make that commitment, but it was hard for people to make that commitment. They did proselytize. They tried to get new converts, and they were very successful at certain times. And at other times, it was more difficult to get people to make that kind of a life change.
Michael Komenecki, here you are, chief curator at the Farnsworth Art Museum. You've put out this beautiful book, The Shakers, to go along with the exhibit there through January. And I have to say, you know, you think you've seen everything Shaker, and then I opened this book and spent some time with it last night, and I was so moved by the simple, powerful beauty, craftsmanship, I have to say, and deep beauty of what I saw there. It makes you want to run off and become a Shaker. Here's my question. The craftsmanship seems so exquisite, and yet there were only 5,000 or 6,000 Shakers at the very height of the movement, Michael. How did a population that small happen to have among its number? And though there was equality of men and women, they divided the work, so this kind of much of this woodworking, though there's beautiful work that the women did as well, but it would only have been the men, so it's even a smaller number. How did they have this kind of expertise and craftsmanship among their numbers in a population so small, Michael?
Well, I'd have to answer that question from the context of being an art historian, in that, you know, cabinet makers and woodworkers were a fundamental part of any community. If we think back to
18th,
what was 19th required
century, yes.
In the 19th century, the things that people needed in order to simply live their lives required these kinds of skills. I'm blessed by the far more knowledgeable colleagues I have here, both Jerry and Brother Arnold, on this subject. But from my perspective, the things that were made by these people relied on a number of things. Cabinet makers and woodworkers mm-hmm. joined the Shaker communities, and their skills were put to use. I think it's fair to say that the Shakers recognized among their members the skills that they possessed, and they were put to good use. I also think that some of our perspective today among, you know, the wide public mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. is that the Shakers are known for this exquisite furniture, which indeed is a rightful recognition, the furniture of the early 19th century. But they continued to make furniture, which is much less well known, which has less of a market presence and less attraction to a collecting base. I think the Shakers simply put to good use the skills that their members had in order to sustain themselves. And that's a fundamental fact of Shaker life. They needed to do these things to continue.
They sold this to support themselves. Jerry Grant, can you further explain how they reached such exquisite heights of craftsmanship? Was it to do with their devotion to work and perfection, part of their religious discipline? Or did they just go out and recruit great cabinet makers and more?
I have a couple thoughts from what Michael was saying. One is, you know, most artists and craftspeople are known by the best of their work. And I think we know the Shakers by the best of their work. Mm-hmm. That's the international appeal of Shaker design and Shaker furniture. There certainly are many, many examples that sit in museum storerooms that never get exhibited, and they're still made by the same people, motivated, we would hope, by the same kind of motivation. You know, the Shakers' founder, Mother Ann Lee, said, you know, if you put your hands to work and hearts to God, that's something that gets repeated often. I often flip that around and think, you know, if your heart is given to God, if he's your boss, then the work of your hands will be remarkable. And I think, you know, looking at it that way, you have a group of people who are constantly trying to do their best. And that, I think, produces some remarkable results, whether Shakers or non-Shakers. When people are committed that way, they do extraordinary things.
It was not easy to be a Shaker. There are three left. Now, a 1974 documentary came out. Sister Lillian Phelps, a Shaker, was 94 then. And here she talks about celibacy among Shakers. Sister Lillian Phelps.
Now, I wouldn't say it didn't cost me anything to adopt a celibate life. I would have liked, probably, a home and a family. But I saw that it was a step higher. When I made up my mind to that, I saw the other side much clearer, and I grew to love it. But it was a cross.
Sister Lillian Phelps, Shaker, in 1974, there was a step higher, she says, she found. Three Shakers live today. One of them will be with us just after this break. Brother Arnold Had. Behind me right here, the Boston Camerata and Joel Cohen with The Harvest from the 2000 CD, The Golden Harvest, Shaker Chants and Spirituals, recorded at Sabbath Day Lake in New Gloucester, Maine, where Brother Arnold lives. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
"'Twas by Christ the seed was sown. Now the harvest does appear. Now the crops are fully grown. Reap, oh reap, get every spear. 'Twas by Christ the seed was sown. Now the harvest does appear. Now the crops are fully grown.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking back this hour on the Shakers and talking with one of the surviving three in the world about Shaker ways, Shaker beliefs. Yes, they're furniture, but there's a lot more there than that. Michael Komanecki is with us. He's chief curator at the Farnsworth Art Museum in Rockland, Maine. They have a big exhibit on through January of Shaker artifacts, a book out, The Shakers from Mount Lebanon to the World. Absolutely wonderful to see the physical manifestations of what they created. There's much more than that, and we'll hear about it in just a moment from one of the three remaining Shakers in the world. Brother Arnold Hyatt is standing by and will join us in just a second here. Jerry Grant is also with us from Albany, New York. He's Director of Collections and Research at the Shaker Museum in Mount Lebanon, New York. Mount Lebanon, the site of the first Shaker community in the United States. Another little bit from the 74 documentary, The Shakers. Here was Eldress Marguerite Frost from the once-active Canterbury, New Hampshire Shaker community, talking about the challenges of watching her community shrink.
If this is what you're going to accept, although it means everybody goes the other way, you have to go on, it's not easy. And I wouldn't have anybody think it is. But they shouldn't accept the charge and start on the way unless they're determined to go through with it.
And three have remained so. Sister June Carpenter, she's 76 and lives at the Sabbath Day Lake Shaker community in New Gloucester, Maine. Sister Frances Carr, she's 87 and lives at the same community in Sabbath Day Lake, the Sabbath Day Lake Shaker community. And Brother Arnold Had, 57 years old, joined the Shakers 36 years ago. Brother Arnold Had joins us from Portland, Maine. Brother Arnold, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
What drew you to join the Shakers?
Well, that was a very long journey, and it began in a way which I probably had no understanding of at the time. But I have many faults, and in 57 years, I've probably gotten even more of them. But when I was 16, I was a very determined young man who, even as of today, I can't stop being this person, which is, if I'm right, I'm right, and I'm not going to let somebody tell me I'm wrong. And I had gone to the Restoration Hancock Shaker Village with my family.
In western Massachusetts.
Massachusetts, mm-hmm. right on the border, right mm-hmm. next to Mount Lebanon, actually, mm-hmm. on the other side of the state.
In New York, yeah.
And the tour guide gave me some information which I had known was wrong because my grandmother had known the Enfield, Connecticut Shakers. Mm-hmm. And she, in particular, was very fond of somebody named Ricardo Belden. And Brother Ricardo had had an argument with the elder, had left the community, and had moved to Springfield, Massachusetts, where I was from, and was happenstantially living next door to my grandparents. Mm-hmm. So I knew that he had been out in the world for a number of years, and then he rejoined. And the tour guide said that he was a lifelong Shaker. And I spoke to her afterwards and said, I learned a lot about the Shakers, and I was very interested because they were a communal group. But I knew one thing she said was wrong, and that was that Brother Ricardo was not a lifetime member. And she told me quite emphatically I was 16 years old, and what did I think I knew? So I was in their reception center. They had a map, and it showed that there were two communities still left. And because of family ties to the state of Maine, I chose to write to the Sabbath Day Lake Shakers. And I enclosed a little index card in which I had typed Brother Ricardo's name. I asked when he was born, when he joined, when he left, when he rejoined, and when he died. And my plan was to go back to Hancock and show this tour guide that she was wrong, because the Shakers, the living authorities, would show that I was right.
Brother Arnold, allow me to ask you if I may, and I know there's a flow here, but I want to cut to this if I may. You were a determined and maybe stubborn young man. That's something quite different, you know, to really wanting to prove a point from joining the Shakers and staying with it your whole life with everything that it requires. What is it about the Shaker way that held you once you joined it?
Well, again, that was part of the process, because I didn't go back to Hancock because Brother Theodore Johnson, who was the elder at the time, responded to me, and the very first Shaker he had ever met was Brother Ricardo. And I was so intrigued by the response, we corresponded, and during that correspondence, I was invited to come up to see it for myself. I came as a visitor, not intending to be a Shaker, but somebody who had never been anywhere in my life where I felt so at home, and these strangers were like family. And it sort of just drew me in, and what culminated in it was worship. And our meeting is different from any other kind of worship service I had ever been a part of. And as I started visiting over 2 or 3 years, the idea about being a Shaker grew stronger and stronger in me until finally I asked if I could be considered for the life, and I was accepted. And what's drawn me was that living out of a faith 24 hours a day, and not just on going on Sunday or giving up a little bit, but it's requiring the whole. And it hasn't, as you heard Sister Lillian and Sister Marguerite said, it's mm-hmm. not necessarily an easy life. But if it's something you're called to, if it's something you're convicted of and you feel it's the truth, well, it's worth fighting for.
What's the hardest thing about being a Shaker? It's clearly not easy, or more people might have done it.
Well, you can't do it on your own. And you really have to have a calling. And that's the whole crux of it. You have to view the community not only as your family and your home and your life and your faith, but very much you have to be wooed in by God as being your lover. If you are not really married to Christ in that sense, you can't do it. And that's what keeps it together. And that love that we share is both the greatest joy and also the biggest pain, because it's not necessarily easy to be with some people. You know, naturally you're drawn to some and mm-hmm. not to others. Mm-hmm. And you have to let personality go and start to just concentrate on the true nature of what God is. And God is that universal love. And if God gives us and forgives us and loves us, then that's what we're called to do too.
Are you trying to reenact the community of Jesus on earth? Are you trying to establish, you know, what the religious may call the kingdom of God on earth?
Oh, very much so. Sure, to live the heavenly life now.
How's it going?
Well, that's a great question. It's going all right, and it's not going so hot all at the same time. Last night, we had a very powerful meeting. Jerry Grant mentioned earlier that August 6th, 1774, is a very important day for the Shakers because that's right, when we arrived in America. Mm-hmm. And so it's one of two very, very important special Shaker holidays. And so we had a commemorative meeting last night that was very powerful and brings – it just shows that the past is not so much the past as it is part of the present, and how we are conjoined to all of those people, especially Mother Ann, who have gone on before us, and how present they are and how they're still a guiding light and a source of strength for those of us who are still continuing on.
I want to ask you about Mother Ann, because the role of male and female is very interesting in the Shaker community. There's celibacy, so it's not a sexual relationship between Mother Ann, the big leader who brought the Shakers to America. Couple of things. One, I'm reading here that in the Shaker view, God is both male and female. And I wonder how you look at that. And then Mother Ann, I see here described in some of the writing about Shakers as having manifested the second coming, much discussed in Christianity, of Christ. Is God male and female in Shaker view? It was Mother Ann the Second Coming, Brother Arnold.
Okay. Well, so God is spirit. God is not corporal. So God is not a male and God is not a female. But within, in the Shaker understanding of the Godhead, within that spirit, there is both a maleness and a femaleness. And you go back to Genesis where God said, let us go down and make man into our own image, and therefore he made them male and female. And all of creation is divided up between both male and female. And we believe if that pattern is not in God, then it couldn't really exist. So that's the manifestation of our Father, Mother, God. Now, Mother Anne never claimed to be, and nor do we believe, that she was the second appearance of Christ. I think it's better to understand her in the terms of St. Paul, more of a superlative apostle. And she always describes Christ as being her Lord and Savior, her head, her husband. And the equality of the – it's really – it's not just gender equality. The Shakers have always practiced equality, that God has made all of us, and therefore we are one family.
And, the Shakers made it real in leadership right up. There was right. no point at which women weren't part of that, the leadership.
Oh, absolutely, and right from the beginning, too.
Mm-hmm. Brother Arnold Head, please stand by. Jerry Grant, Michael Komenek, we have lots of callers on the Shaker front of all things. Let's go first to Texas, Austin, Texas, and Lisa. Lisa, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My family goes back in Kentucky hundreds of years, and a relative of mine long, long ago became a member of the Shaker community at Pleasant Hill, Kentucky.
Okay.
She was widowed, and I think quite late in life, and I visited with my grandmother that community, and I was told that that's one way the Shakers acquired new members, since you couldn't be married, was widows or widowers, and I just remember it's when I was much younger when I visited, that it was the most beautiful community, and it was once a very vibrant, active Shaker community. And, of course, it has many examples of their furniture and just their amazing design ability. But one thing I remember being told was that in addition to the furniture that they're so famous for, they also are credited with inventing many different things to make their work life easier.
Yes. I'm reading here a list, the rotary harrow, the circular saw, the clothespin, no less, the flat broom, the wheel-driven washing machine.
Yes, the broom. I remember being told about that and being shown examples.
It's kind of incredible. So much innovation, and again, out of such a small community. How do you feel about having a Shaker in the family, Lisa?
I'm sorry?
How do you feel about having had a Shaker in the family?
Oh, I just thought it was amazing. My grandmother and her sister, who is now 90 years old, were very into genealogy. They did a lot of research. They went to the Mormon library, just did traveling and amassed a ton of information. And so that's how I learned about this. And this woman, I believe she, I don't remember when Pleasant Hill was formed. It was either in the late 1700s or early 1800s, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe she's buried there. That's what I was told.
Lisa, I so appreciate your call. Thank you very much. Jerry Grant, what about how this community sustained itself and grew? I was reading last night that, yes, indeed, one of the streams or some of the streams, widows, foundlings, abandoned babies, orphans, and of course people who joined as Brother Arnold joined just out of attraction to it. But these were all streams that helped grow a celibate community, Jerry.
I think, Tom, that there was no member any better for the Shakers to bring in than a believing adult, one who joined on faith. Those were the strongest converts that they could make. But those might have been rare at certain times, and the Shakers over the years were willing to try other ways to build their community and to populate their families enough that they could conduct the business of being Shakers and living that way. And some of that was taking in children and indentured children and, as you say, foundlings. And they tried all of that. I think, you know, Brother could express the success rate at which that worked for them, but I think it was not as great as they would have liked. I think that, and it's we have not done the statistical analysis, but I think, you know, I often picture, you know, the widow with five children who is basically her husband dies and she's turned out of her house and doesn't really have any place to go, finding the Shaker community as a, if she's a believing kind of person, as a perfect home for her. Her children are cared for, she's taken care of, she has work, her children get trained, educated. It seems like a pretty good option for people back then. Now, people have many more options when they're put in that position.
Jerry, remind us of the period in which Shakers saw their greatest growth, the so-called Great Awakening. This wasn't happening in a vacuum. There was a big cultural movement underway in this country and beyond, Jerry.
Right, and I think for the Shakers, they... you know, there were a number of revivals happening right around the time of the American Revolution and leading up to the great Kentucky revivals in 1800 and
this intense wave of religiosity and belief, the awakening, great awakening.
Yes. And for the Shakers, I think the result of that was their greatest successes in gaining new members was probably from 1805 to 1820, around that period.
Brother Arnold, if I may, was there a time that you're aware of when Shakers thought, you know, we may achieve liftoff here, we may live and demonstrate the holy life so effectively that it becomes a seed that takes over the culture, that, you know, that will lead humanity en masse into this path?
Well, there was a very strong feeling in the early 1820s that because of the growth Jerry was talking about, they saw that as the frontier went on, they were just going to continue to grow. But the then head of the church, Mother Lucy Wright, says, "You're wrong. We are small and we will always be a small church." And had they listened to her better, they would have been able to cope more with the changes that came really to force just within a decade following her death in 1821. When the community was really trying to fill up the ranks with all of these orphans. And what they were seeing was that really the orphans didn't work, but instead of giving up on them, they just put more and more emphasis into them and continued to have that feeling right into the 1900s that this is how they were going to get their members.
Wow, what a way to go. How do you feel? I mean, here you are now. There are three. Sister Frances, she's 87. Sister June, 76. You're 57. We talk about the last of the Mohicans. Are you the last of the Shakers, Brother Arnold?
Well, I have less hair than the Mohicans, but I certainly hope not. You know, one thing that belies the fact is that we keep hearing the word 333, but we have had – I've lived at the community for 36 years, and there have been over 30 people who have gone so far in our process as to – come in and start trying to live the life. Some of them have lasted a month or two. Most of them are 1 or 2 years, and some of them have been there, you know, stayed more than a decade. So we still have interest. We still have people who want to become Shakers, and if they fulfill the requirements and all of that, then we hopefully will still get Shakers.
Rejoice and be be truth alone thine honor. Rejoice and be exceeding glad, my soul, renew thine honor. With righteousness of saints be clad, be truth alone thine honor.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking back this hour on the Shakers and talking with one of the surviving three in the world about their ways, about Shaker beliefs, yes, Shaker furniture, and a whole lot more. Big exhibit underway at the Farnsworth Art Museum in Rockland, Maine. Its chief curator, Michael Komenecki, is with me here, also author of the companion book, The Shakers from Mount Lebanon to the World. Absolutely wonderful collection of artifacts and objects, an expression of the Shaker view of life and religion, faith, the world, even heaven found right there. Jerry Grant is with us, Director of Collections and Research at the Shaker Museum in Mount Lebanon in New York, the first site of the first Shaker community in America that came over in 1774. And with us from Portland, Maine, Brother Arnold Had, along with Sister June Carpenter and Sister Frances Carr. He is one of three Shakers, you'd have to say, in the world right now. Interesting response online here. Omaha guy says, a failed religion can be seen as a complete success when people simply live enjoying God instead of obsessing about how to manage a religious institution or maximize growth or gain market share. Then they have time to enjoy really good furniture on a Sabbath day of rest. I like that. Brother Arnold, Wanda says, if they were to recruit today, they might well swell the ranks again. Many are so tired of the fast-paced life, it might be inviting. I have the same thought, Brother Arnold. You know, you got all kinds of young people looking, wanting to farm, go organic, get away from the city, join the maker movement, which seems kind of shakery to me. You'd think there might be a chance. There's only three. Maybe you're not the last of the Mohicans.
Well, that's possible. But, you know, all those things you describe are fine, but that's all peripheral. That's not what a Shaker is. A Shaker is someone who's a seeker after the kingdom of God.
Mm-hmm.
And what else we do is something to support ourselves. So it's all well and good, and we have a lot of friends and volunteers who come who want to help in the gardens or want to paint or do something else, and that's all great and wonderful. But the commitment to the life is not a commitment to be a farmer or a furniture maker or a cook or a herdsman. It's to be a Shaker and then to learn the trades that you need, that the community needs you to have so that they can survive.
Let's go to Jerry, also in Austin, Texas. Jerry, you're on the air. Thank you for joining us.
Yes. Hi. Thank you for taking my call, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
I'll mention first and briefly that I'm a descendant of Shakers from the same Pleasant Hill community that started in the early 19th century in Kentucky.
May I just ask, because people may be wondering with you and Lisa, how do you descend from Shakers? They're celibate.
Well, in my case, my, I think, fifth great-grandparents, Phineas and Charity Runyon, when they became elderly, they and their extended family moved to Pleasant Hill, and the oldest son wasn't among that group, and so that's why I'm here. I felt like I dodged.
yes. But how wonderful. And the names Phineas and Jerry Runyon, I just love it. So what's your thought, Jerry, descendant of Shakers?
It's actually Jerry Young. Well, early on, you were talking about how remarkable it is from such a small community. So many inventions arose. And one of the things that struck me was the notion that so many people were songwriters and that if
Shakers you're saying, to be very clear. Yes, there's a lot of music that came.
Right. And mm-hmm. and Simple Gifts is the most famous song, and gift mm-hmm. is a word that comes up much in among the Shakers.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that if you're plowing and God gives you a gift, which is an idea or a song, you put down the plow, you accept the gift. And by extension, you recognize that other people have gifts
mm-hmm.
and that came from the same source, and you respect those things. So I think that the Shakers as a community of people that respect one another and listen to one another was just beautifully a fertile ground for that kind of innovation just because they listen to each other.
Jerry, you're a worthy descendant. You paint a wonderful picture of putting down the plow when the gift of a song comes to mind from God, as a Shaker might have it. I so appreciate your call. Michael, Brother Arnold reminds us that it's not all about the objects and artifacts, and yet they are so powerful in their representation of a mindset, of a devotion to a kind of perfection, of an urge towards simplicity. Give us a sense of the range of artifacts, objects that you're exhibiting at the museum and their legacy in so much of the design world today. Here, Libby writes to us, Michael. She says she visited the Hancock Shaker Village as a child. She says it shaped my view of architecture and interiors. It's reflected in my work as a designer today. I feel like the Shaker fingerprints are all over our modern design world. But give us a sense of the range of objects, artifacts, design impulses that you're showing, Michael.
Well, our intent from the beginning was to give a visitor a much broader understanding of Shaker life and the things that they made in order to sustain themselves. Most Shaker exhibitions and publications have mm-hmm. focused on this so-called classic period of Shaker furniture, which
ladder
is
ladder chairs and all the rest.
Absolutely. It's beautiful.
It is.
And it influenced a generation of artists and others, the kind of design that you're correspondent had suggested. All that's true. But there's a practicality that drives it all. These were things the Shakers needed in order to live. If you were a community of 200 people and you had to wash clothes and blankets and bed linens, how are you going to do that? for 200 people, mm-hmm. because that's what the Shakers undertook. Mm-hmm. And if you're serving meals for 100 people at a time, that tells you how big the tables have to be, and benches and bowls and baskets to collect things and carry things from one part of the village to another.
So
and
form these, as function, finding an early group of supporters here, generators.
Yes, but most of the things that the Shakers designed were simply a product of their own time and place. These were not specifically unique to the Shakers. Indeed, many of the people who made these things had gifts in order to produce a basket. But a basket maker didn't make one basket. They could have made hundreds. Oval boxes, for example, among the best-known things that the Shakers made, and beautiful, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. were made by many Shaker brothers in many villages. Brother Delmer Wilson at Sabbath Day Lake made some extraordinary ones. But there's a photograph of him from the early 20th century in his workshop in the winter where he is standing there, and there are oval boxes stacked from floor to ceiling all around him. That's what he did in winter. And why? Because they sold them and to raise money to sustain the village. Mm-hmm. So the connection between aesthetics and practicality is not always clear in the minds of most visitors. And, you know, it's our hope that we're helping people understand the practical nature of these people.
Brother Arnold, Mother Ann Lee, I'm reading here, urged this hands to work, hearts to God, and this principle, the admonition to sweep clean, it's written here, meaning both the rooms, just to be clean, and the floor of the heart. Kind of urge to simplicity there, Brother Arnold?
Well, it's simplicity and openness to God, and I really appreciated Jerry's call from Texas there in understanding about gift, because to a Shaker, everything we receive is a gift of God and from God. So that sweeping clean means to sweep that thing clean so that you're not having any of those impurities, you're not having any hate, you're not having any anger. All of those things have to go away.
It sounds like a tall order, or does it become habit over a lifetime? You're 57.
It's a tall order. It doesn't change. I mean, maybe it lessens a little bit, but it never changes because human nature will always be human nature.
But what does it mean? You're not exactly Amish. I mean, we had to call you this morning and got you on your cell phone. You'd silenced it during morning meeting, morning prayers, but there's a cell phone in your pocket. You're not Amish, I guess, then at all.
Bingo. Well, you know, the innovation thing should have clued you in on that.
Yes.
Shakers, Mother says, hands to work, hearts to God. She doesn't say, kill yourself doing it. We try to work smarter. Not be consumers necessarily, but to take on in the life anything that makes labor easier, lighter. I mean, you know, like having a dishwasher, having automatic washing machines, having a microwave. We do have television. We take three daily newspapers, lots of periodicals, so we're abreast of what's going on in the world. We entertain constantly. So, I mean, we have an influx of people and ideas and
so could you be a Shaker astronaut or a Shaker race car driver?
That might be difficult because one thing is we are still pretty cloistered. I mean, in the sense that, you know, we still do live separate from the world. So basically what we do is with only having three people, we need as many hands on deck as possible.
You must find others who support you in that with three and two over 70.
Right. Well, we do have employees. And like I said earlier, we have friends. In fact, we have a formal organization called the Friends of the Shakers who have their annual gathering at the village this very weekend. And they will be celebrating their 40th anniversary with us.
That's beautiful. A kind of celebration of and with you. Suzanne in Buffalo, New York. Suzanne, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. Hi.
Hi.
And a shout out and hello to Brother Arnold and to Sister Frances. I'm former director and curator of the Shaker Museum in Shaker Heights, Ohio, where the North Union community was located.
Shaker Heights, as in Shaker, once again? Was that a Shaker?
Correct.
Okay, okay.
Well, yeah, the North Union Shakers owned the land on which the Shaker Heights, most of the Shaker Heights properties are now located.
Occam's razor. It's the most obvious answer is the answer. Okay, what's your
exactly.
thoughts, Suzanne?
Well, I originally wanted to point out that not only were the Shakers innovators in physical things, but also in their social structure and in their spirituality and religion.
Oh, how so? Describe what you mean by that, Suzanne. That's very interesting.
Well, first of all, the I think everything derived from the mother, father, God principle.
That is male and female in God.
Male and female God. They prayed to mother, father, God. Correct me if I'm correct, Brother
mm-hmm,
Arnold.
Mm-hmm.
I attended many of the meetings and so on when I was living there in the winter doing research for my master's thesis on the inventions and innovations of the Shakers.
So how did that play out in terms of religion or social structure? What's the implication of that?
Well, I think the implication is that because of the mother-father-God principle, you had the male and female lead, male and female trustees in the various businesses, they had a lot of businesses because they... at one point, they were manufacturing things, and they had peddlers going out and selling them, but they also had people coming to the community to purchase things. So they had to have accountants. They had to have people keeping track. They published. I own one of the books by Aurelia Mace called Aletheia, meaning truth in Greek.
Mm-hmm.
I own several other books, The Manifesto, and so on. So they published, very strong in their commitment to male and female leads and
community structure. What about the implications there?
Well, the implications there were that the brothers were responsible for the kinds of jobs that they were skilled and talented in doing, and the sisters were also. But you know, take a look at the circular saw, Tobias the Babbitt, a woman. Invented it because she was at her spinning wheel watching the brothers laboriously sawing, from the pit. They had one guy down in the
pit. Up and down, the old way.
Down,
yep.
And she said, wow, look at that. They're working so hard. And she's looking at her spinning wheel, and all of a sudden she said, So she took her idea to one of the brothers in a shop, fashioned some tooth on a sheet of tin. She took it back, tried it on the spinning wheel. Boom, it worked. So, the invention of the circular saw.
Empower women, and you may find yourself empowered yourself. Pretty good idea from the spinning wheel there. Suzanne, our time grows short, and I'm very glad for your call. But if I may, Jerry Grant, what began to close the door on the great day of Shakers, the most populous era of the Shakers? Was it the industrialization of the country? Was it urbanization? What brought the pressure on, Jerry?
I'll make two comments, and then... And we'll see. One is, I think, the world changed a lot. There was a day when I imagined that people walking down the street, when they greeted each other on the sidewalk, might discuss the sermon that they'd heard that Sunday in church. I think that day passed when religion, your personal beliefs, your willingness to talk about your beliefs decreased considerably as the world became much more complicated. That's a part of it. And the other is people, I mentioned earlier, people had more options. As people were able to travel, as cities grew, the agricultural life decreased, people found different kind of communities to live in. Even after the family unit started dispersing as people moved to cities and moved across country, people found different kinds of communities to support them.
Much less religious and more individually oriented. Shakers on the short end of that. Brother Arnold, you're one of three. I feel like I want to give you the last. I find the Shaker legacy very beautiful. I find the ideas very beautiful. Maybe you'll find a convert today. What's your pitch?
Okay, Tom. Well, if you're ready, we have a room at Sabbath Day. Come up and try it. Our big pitch is that we want people to know we are there and that we're still there. We're still available. We have websites. We're on – like us on Facebook as our
And why should someone become a Shaker today? Why?
Because they're still called to the authenticity of that life of Christ. And again, it has to be an inward calling. But if they know we're there, we're doing our job by making sure that they hear us. We can't draw them in. They have to do that themselves.
What do you think are the chances that 50 years from now we'll have Shakers to talk to, Brother Arnold?
To be honest with you, Tom, I still very much believe that is what's going to happen. I do not believe that I'm the last Shaker.
Are Sister June and Sister Frances on board with you there in your
little
community?
They are. Every day, right? Every day in our morning prayers, we pray most earnestly for competent vocations to be brought to this way of life so that Shakerism will endure in this place we so lovingly call Chosen Land.
Maybe there are feet walking toward you right now, who knows, or ears perked up and wondering. We certainly wish you well, and we...
Well, thank you, Tom. Peace, and thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you. Brother Arnold Hadd, one of three surviving Shakers. We honor that tradition. Michael Kamenecki at the Farnsworth Art Museum in Rockland, Maine. Beautiful representation of it in objects there. Thank you so much for being with us today, Michael.
My pleasure. Thanks, Tom.
And Jerry Grant at the Shaker Museum in Mount Lebanon, New York. Jerry, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom. And I just need to say, if you're a seeker, read about the Shakers and go visit.
There's much to be found. Of course, Aaron Copland's Appalachian Spring celebrated simple gifts right in the thick of it. Here's Leonard Bernstein and the New York Philharmonic. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.